Today our guest is our friend Mark McCalish. He's testified previously before the Disclosure Project and has worked for many of the top aerospace companies and has appeared on several shows. Hello, Mark. Nice to have you back.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think since you've been involved with the Disclosure Project and different things like that, you sort of have a handle on these different, let's say, conspiracies and things that might be going on. Am I right?
Well, I do have a few contacts throughout the defense industry and a couple of folks in the intelligence community as well.
Well, today I thought we might discuss Bin Laden and also 9/11. So I'd like to ask you right off the bat, do you think there really is a Bin Laden or was a Bin Laden?
What do you mean?
I mean, do you think that there actually was a person named Bin Laden that really was controlling Al-Qaeda?
Yes, I do.
And why do you feel that way?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it'd be difficult for anybody to build a complete personality with a dossier like that, and have as many historical facts line up as they did with the case of Bin Laden. I mean, it was known that the Bin Laden family had dealings with the Bush family from the oil industry. You know, his family history, his educational background, all these things are things that can be tracked down and traced. So I don't think there's any doubt that he was a real person. As to his level of involvement in the events surrounding 9/11, I've had some doubts about that. And it seems that there are several other personalities that probably had more of a hand in the actual engineering of that plan than Bin Laden did. But I think that Bin Laden sort of became the boogeyman that everybody pointed to as the reason for maintaining the postures that they did politically and as far as, you know, creating this the war that we've been involved in. I mean, in fact, I've had sources tell me that both sides encouraged the idea that he was still alive somewhere, sort of surreptitiously planning things from afar, because it was in the...
Are you talking about after we said we killed him?
No.
Oh, okay.
Leading up to the time when he was taken out.
Well, do you think that he's really dead?
Yeah, I do. I think he is. The fact that they haven't shown any photographs is a little bit of a question mark for me, because, for example, there was a person that called into one of the political commentary radio shows. It might have been Sean Hannity's program. A person called in and said, well, you know, back when Obama was a senator, he had no qualms at all about the terrible pictures that were taken of our soldiers tormenting Iraqi prisoners in Abu Ghraib, the prison there, and all these humiliating little acts that they were doing. And it didn't bother him as to the kind of reaction in the Muslim community that would create. And yet now he's concerned about the kinds of reactions that releasing these photographs of Osama bin Laden's body after the killing took place. You know, he doesn't want to release those. So,
well, don't you think that maybe... I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. But don't you think that maybe people get a different perspective when they're the president from what they had when they were either a senator or a representative? Don't you think they're more conscious of history, maybe?
Well, not only that, but they have a lot more access to the intelligence that's available as president of the United States. And even in the position of president, I'm certain that there are some aspects of the information that is out there in the interest of national security that even the president may never see. He may receive information peripherally in order for him to make an executive decision, but I think there are things that he probably doesn't know about either.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some people, you know, that think bin Laden has been dead for years. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, I heard there is someone who's been deeply involved in this in the intelligence community who made some comments not too long ago that indicated that the whole idea that bin Laden was suffering from kidney disease and was in constant need of medical attention and access to a dialysis machine, that was kind of a myth that was floated in the early part of this new century, right after 2001. That you know gave the interested parties kind of a built-in escape valve, if you will, to say, well, he probably is already dead. We haven't heard any more propaganda recordings or videotapes from him, so he's probably died of kidney disease. That was just a way for them to sort of walk away from the whole idea that we were going to catch him and bring him to justice one way or the other, either with a bullet or with a trial. And but I think that, you know, I've known people with that kind of a problem, that kind of kidney disease issue, and they don't really, they don't persist for 10 or 15 years with that level of medical treatment required without succumbing to the disease. And so the fact that he's still alive and they would, you know, put a helicopter that is, you know, a super advanced stealth version of the Black Hawk helicopter, put that kind of an asset in jeopardy to go into Pakistan, that just didn't strike me as something they would do, you know, without some very serious considerations in mind.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a funny thing. You look at a lot of these leaders that have been around for years. I shouldn't say have been around for years, but in the past. Like Adolf Hitler, he must have had three or four doubles, you know. Same with Stalin.
Well, I think there has been some kind of documentation of that, and even in the case of Osama bin Laden, there was a number of photographs, some of which you can find up on the internet, that clearly show that the so-called double was a strategy that they employed to try and maintain his safety. When he was moving around, and you know, even the president of the United States probably has a double.
I wouldn't doubt it. Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, these are people that you know, the different groups, our country, their country, or you know, whatever tribe or nation you're talking about, they have, you know, a serious vested interest in maintaining the safety of these individuals that, you know, have been, you know, brought to a leader position, a leadership position. You know, it's not something that you parade around for anybody to take a poke at.
Well, one of the things that bothers me personally is we have a supposed Al-Qaeda leader. He's living in a compound that has no guards, and he's supposed to be the most wanted man in the world. Does this make sense to you, or am I just crazy?
I think it tells you everything we need to know about the relationship he had with the higher levels of leadership in the Pakistani army. I mean, there's even a fairly amount of reliable intelligence that the Pakistani intelligence services helped supply and to provide intelligence for radical Islamic terrorists who attacked Mumbai in India a couple years back. So, you know, the fact that he did not have, you know, multiple layers of protection other than, you know, 17-foot-high wall, and that he was basically living about, you know, a mile or so from Pakistani equivalent of West Point, you know, a big army officer training facility. This tells you that there were people in the local environment that knew who was living there, and that they felt that you know, it was a secret that was being kept well enough that you know, there was no need for, you know, any overt protection. But you know, obviously, it wasn't enough.
Well, do you think that he had an organization that was actually capable of the acts of 9/11, performing these acts?
Well, I know that, for example, in the 1980s when the Russians were moving down through Afghanistan, that he had a working relationship with the CIA and the military, that they were providing him Stinger missiles to take out, you know, Russian helicopters and things of that nature. And part of the reason I know that is because I worked for General Dynamics, who was the company that built those missiles in the early 1980s. So I recognized these weapon systems when they were, you know, found discarded after use. You know, it seemed obvious that, you know, he was someone who we thought enough of to fight against the Russians and hopefully keep them out of the Middle East to one degree or another. But the big mistake that I think the U.S. government made was that there was no economic follow-up. There was no support for the tribes and the people in that area after the Russians left. And I think that if we had done more to support them economically, to help them refurbish and reestablish their infrastructure, that we wouldn't have become the great Satan that they eventually painted us to be, because we simply walked away after the mess was done. You know, I think it was a very big mistake politically.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the name of the movie that was about that, a famous movie, but I can't recall it right now.
Charlie's War or something?
Something like that, but it had his last name too, but I can't think of it. But anyway, do you think that there were people in high positions in this country that may have used him as a cover for some bigger crime?
Well, you know, I think there's more to the 9/11 story than a lot of people in the government would ever admit. What I will admit about myself is that I really believe that, you know, there was a lot more happening in the attacks in New York and in Washington, D.C. on the Pentagon than just some planes being flown into buildings.
Right.
And the reason I say this is because, you know, there's a lot of technology that's quite a bit more widespread now than it was in the, you know, late 90s, early 2000, and that has to do with the manufacture of something called nanoparticles. Now, it turns out that, you know, when they do a controlled demolition on a building, you know, you can use dynamite and thermite, which is a kind of explosive that creates high temperatures that will melt steel. But it turns out that when you manufacture nanoparticles of aluminum oxide and you combine them in the explosives, it creates a new grade of explosive called thermate. Now, thermate is unique in that when you put the aluminum oxide into this reaction, it creates a built-in reaction during the explosive process that supplies a tremendous amount of oxygen to the combustion side of the explosion. And it also creates, and I don't know if you're familiar with oxyacetylene welding gear, you provide pure oxygen into the reaction, and it'll melt, you know, steel because the oxygen is there to maintain the temperature and keep the reaction going. Well, this is kind of what aluminum oxide nanoparticles does in thermate explosives. And so as the people removing the remains of the World Trade Center buildings were digging down through all of the steel and concrete and dust, they were finding large pools of molten steel a month to a month and a half, 2 months after
it
collapsed. And the only way you could still have molten steel after that length of time and after all the water, you remember all the fire hoses they had trained on the pile of debris for weeks and weeks because it just seemed like the fires would never go out. And this is why, is because there was thermate explosive being used to bring those buildings down.
Well, can I add a little something to that?
Sure, yes.
That thermite explosive you're talking about, isn't that only wasn't that only at the time supplied to the military?
Well, thermite, yes. Thermate, the kind that uses the aluminum oxide nanoparticles, it was something that was almost exclusively being produced here in the United States and in Russia. It was used almost exclusively for bringing down buildings in a controlled demolition. And one of the signatures of the use of this kind of explosive, and you can find this in the film and the photography of the wreckage, the piles of steel girders sticking up out of the rubble, you'll notice that in many instances, and this is immediately after the collapse of the building, you'll find areas where these huge steel girders, particularly in the center core of the building where the elevators and so forth were, that there were these very clean diagonal cuts on these girders that looked as though a hot knife had passed through butter. And that's a signature of building demolition. That's the way that the explosives are wrapped around the girder on a diagonal. And that is the technique that they use to cause an abrupt collapse of the structure supporting the building so that it falls directly into its own footprint. It's the same process that was used to bring down World Trade Center Building Number 7, which, of course, was never hit by any of the aircraft or the debris from the collision with the buildings. And so, I mean, that should tell you right there that there was something else going on. The Building 7, more than anything else, I mean, you can question.
Building 7 was attached by a walkway, I believe.
Oh, but even so,
yeah.
I mean, introducing a fire into a building that's, you know, 20 or 40 stories high, mm-hmm. There are numerous examples around the world where there have been fires that have started, you know, in the mid-level floors of skyscrapers and burned for days.
Well, no skyscraper has ever come down from a fire. Did you know that?
That's right. That's right. You're absolutely right. And so the fact that the gentleman who was the owner of the World Trade Center, his name for...
I can't remember.
At the moment.
Yeah, me too.
But he said in an interview at one point that they saw that the fires running through the building had caused extreme damage, and so they had decided to pull it, which is a term used in the building demolition business for using explosives to actively destroy the supporting structure of the building and cause it to collapse in its own footprint. And this is exactly what WT-7 did. So yes, I think that there are levels of involvement by other parties other than Osama bin Laden and the terrorists who flew these aircraft into the buildings. There had to have been to bring down these buildings. Now, I watched the films over and over again because I've always had an interest in various kinds of engineering. And even when I run over to the wrecking yard to get parts for one of my older cars that I'm working on, a lot of times I like to study the crumbled up remains of some of the cars that are there just to see how the structural design of these vehicles collapsed under the impact of, you know, hitting a telephone pole or another car, whatever it is, because it shows you how the energy can be distributed through the structure of, something that's been engineered to withstand a certain amount of force, and help you to understand how, not only structures like a building can, you know, maintain their integrity after being hit by an aircraft or if there's a fire, but it can also show you how you can package people in a vehicle to protect them from, you know, collisions coming from the outside of the vehicle. So, you know, I'm convinced that there were other things used to bring those buildings down besides the aircraft.
Well, the buildings themselves were built so that they wouldn't come down if a plane hit them. They were engineered
right.
That way. And
in fact, I think they were engineered to withstand the impact of a Boeing 707.
It was a Boeing 707, but all the engineers that I've talked to agree that the flame from the 747 could never have been hot enough, even with the fuel, to have melted the steel girders.
That's right. I looked up the combustion temperatures of JP7, which I think is the fuel that airliners use these days, and it's something like 1575 degrees, which I'm pretty sure is not even high enough to melt aluminum. They said that a lot of the trusses that supported the floors were aluminum trusses that were hung off of the steel girders that ran on the outsides of the building and then in the central core where the elevators were.
Well, and the thing was, they were treated with fire retardant materials.
That's right.
So
right.
even even if they weren't and it wasn't hot enough, the fire retardant material should have made it impossible for the flames to have melted any of the metal, whether it be aluminum or steel.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, the findings of Professor Stephen Jones from Brigham Young University were it was one of the sources of information that really convinced me that there was something going on behind the scenes that, you know, wasn't immediately evident. And that is a fact that he collected some of the some specimens of the steel girders that had these melted areas on them. He also obtained some of the debris and the dust from the site and had it analyzed with a mass spectrometer, which I believe uses a technique of using lasers to vaporize some of the particles there, and found very clear evidence of aluminum oxide, and it even found some of the residue that is known to be created during the explosive destruction of thermate explosives that clearly indicated that aluminum oxide nanoparticles had in fact been a part, had in fact been a component of what happened there. So to me, I felt that was fairly conclusive information in terms of something other than the aircraft being used to destroy those mm-hmm. buildings. And, you know, I mean, he really paid a heavy price, from what I understand, for making the disclosures that he did. I'm not sure exactly whether he was released from his employment at Brigham Young University, but I know that if it didn't actually jeopardize his employment there, it certainly caused him an awful lot of concern and ridicule.
Well, are you aware of the fact that they found an engine by the World Trade Center, but when they checked it, it was an engine that was never used on those models of 747s.
No, I had never heard that. I had never heard that, although if you watch the video closely, the second impact that occurred, I think it was around 9:30 that morning, the one that everyone was able to witness because there had already been the first impact, you can see what looks like kind of a meteor that sort of carries on straight through the building.
That's
and
right.
Flies
yeah.
out the other side, and uh-huh. with this smoke trail, and it goes for maybe several blocks beyond the building before it comes to rest on the ground. It appeared to me that it was one of the engines, probably the engine on the under the right side wing of that aircraft, and but the idea that this was an engine that was not typically used on that kind of an aircraft is that's a very interesting piece of information. I had never heard that before.
Wow.
Although I will tell you that throughout the commercial airline industry and military variants of these same aircraft, I mean, as you probably know, that the military had for a while an in-flight refueling version of the DC-10 airliner. It was one of the competitors, along with the Boeing 747, in the original heavy lift fly-off that the military asked for from the various aerospace companies, that ultimately led to Lockheed Martin and the Lockheed at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting the contract to build the C-5A Galaxy, which was probably one of the largest aircraft built in the world at the time. It's possible that these aircraft, even variants of the 707, eventually became the KC-135, which has been sustaining in-flight refueling operations for the military for many years. In fact, even to stretch out the longevity of that particular platform, there were a number of proposals put into place for putting larger, more efficient, and an entirely different kind of jet engine on those aircraft, not only to extend their range, but to make the availability of parts and newer technologies in the construction of the engines.
Yeah, but they hadn't been put on the ones that crashed into the tower, supposedly. That's the thing,
yeah.
You know. But did you know that there were several witnesses that swear that they saw a black airplane hit the tower?
Well, you know, I have heard that, and I think that oftentimes, when you consider the time of day this was, in the morning with the sun low on the horizon out in the east. And depending on what the vantage point was of the witness, it's entirely possible that they were looking into the sun and they were more or less viewing a silhouette of the aircraft as it passed across a very brightly lit sky, which would have the effect of making the aircraft look as though it was black. I don't dispute that some people had those kinds of sightings, but, you know, there were videos taken from a number of different vantage points, and the ones that were taken from the east looking west towards the World Trade Center clearly show, an aircraft that's largely metallic, and shiny silver, that kind of thing, you know, with the livery of the, I think it was either United or American Airlines on the aircraft. But you have to remember that when the sun's that low on the horizon, it means that off to the west, the sky is really still a dark blue, a rich dark blue. And it was pretty much a clear sky at the time, so there weren't any clouds that would reflect sunlight. So imagine that you're looking at a shiny, polished silver cylinder, and you're holding it up in front of you, and you've got the sun beyond that, the sun coming basically into your eyes. And this is early in the morning, and behind you is a dark blue sky, basically over your shoulder. You hold that shiny reflective cylinder up, and the part that's mostly the side that you can see will be reflecting the dark blue sky that's behind you.
Let me throw something out for your consideration.
Okay.
During the late 90s, the United States was developing technology, and they were using airplanes, and that technology was to try and hide an airplane visually. What they would do is they would have cameras on one side of the airplane, and they would put screens, like television screens, on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Or they could do the same thing on the top. They could put cameras on the top and screens on the bottom. And why they did this was they would project what was above the plane on the bottom of the plane, make the plane invisible. You've heard of this, I assume, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the industry terminology is for that. I think it's like an active electro-optical skin. And it's something that they've even adapted to military uniforms. And if you look around enough on the Internet, you can actually find some videos that were shot by some Muslim insurgents in Iraq that involves an M1 Abrams tank.
Yes, I know about that. Right.
Rolling through a gap in a wall, and either just before or just after it passes through this gap in the wall, it hits a landmine and sort of grinds to a halt almost completely out of the frame on the left side of the image. You see a couple of insurgents with AK-47s running across the front of the wall, and then the rest of the armored column comes rolling up with another M1 Abrams that parks right in the gap of that wall. And in the midst of all the troops deploying out of these vehicles, you see this blurry image of a human being running in front of the wall. And then right as he passes in front of the silhouette of the number two M1 Abrams, you can see the figure of a man climbing up onto the tank and laying down on top of the turret, and he's almost completely transparent.
Right. Well,
and in fact,
I'm sorry. I was going to say, I want to take this a step further, though. What I want to say to you is, what do you think of this idea? Because it has been proposed that the planes that hit the World Trade Center were not Boeing 747s, but were planes made to look like Boeing 747s using this technology.
Well, I'm sure you're probably unfamiliar with the actual type. I think they were actually 767s.
Okay.
Or 777s. But yeah, so 747s was, I think they were built back in the early 70s. And the aircraft that were used were a much more recent vintage, something like a 767, which although they only have two very large high-bypass turbofan engines, they're as large as a 747 in terms of their bulk and the tonnage that they take aloft. So, yeah, it's a... I suppose that I've talked to people who say they have seen that kind of technology, that you can make one aircraft type look like something else. How something like that is engineered, I mean, to completely change what the platform looks like, is a bit of a mystery to me. I can certainly imagine that it's possible, but what the benefit or the payoff of that would be, I'm not really sure. I mean, are you suggesting that these could have been aircraft built somewhere else in the world and they're only being made to look like a United or an American Airlines airliner?
Well, I am suggesting that some people say that these were planes that were not what they seemed to be. I'm not saying they were built anywhere else in the world. They might have been some sort of drone, for example, you know, that had nobody on board.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things. I mean, for example, finding the, I think it was either the driver's license or the passport of one of the terrorists who'd been in the cockpit of one of these planes, fully intact, laying on the ground.
Yeah, that's right.
A couple of blocks down the street. I mean, that, to me, that sounds so much like a plant. The idea that someone sitting in the cockpit, which is the initial point of contact when you're flying at, you know, just under Mach 1 into a building, the idea that a document like that could survive that kind of situation is utterly ridiculous in my mind. So, you know, I mean, there's even been, I think it was some investigative reporters from the BBC actually went over in the Middle East, and they tracked down some of the people who were alleged to have been responsible for flying those planes and found them alive and well and still working in the airline industry.
That's absolutely correct, and yet their names are still on the list as being terrorists.
I know.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's something ain't kosher, as they say.
That's for sure.
And, you know, so exactly what happened, I think there's more going on there than meets the eye. But, you know, who ultimately is responsible? I mean, there's so many rumors floating around the whole 9/11 scenario, it's hard to exactly know what was going on. But I think that what's pretty clear is that, like Pearl Harbor, this is an incident that was, you know, sort of the tipping point that got the American public to fully commit to a war on terror and going after Muslim extremists in the Middle East. I mean, you know, it's that kind of, I mean, you know, you remember people driving around with, you know, American flags taped to the radio antennas on their car and things like that. I mean, that was something that persisted for months after 9/11. There was a surge of patriotism across the country that, I mean, I felt very proud to see, you know, the outpouring of patriotism on the part of many people. And you know, unfortunately, a lot of it was driven by anger and hatred. And I don't always think that people make good decisions when, you know, they're reacting in that particular way. You know, obviously there were a lot of big corporations that benefited handsomely from the war in the Middle East.
Absolutely.
The Gulf War and the war, you know, Operation Iraqi Freedom. Whether or not we really brought a lasting peace and democracy to that part of the world is a question I think is probably not going to be answered for maybe another 40, 50 years. Because, you know, the traditions and the customs of people in that part of the world are something that have been in place for hundreds, if not thousands, of years, and so breaking their belief system and their cycles of, you know, daily activity, you know, I don't know whether you can really do that with a war and expect that it's going to be a lasting result.
Well, I don't think we really cared. I mean, quite frankly.
Well, no, but I think what is true is that a lot of people made a lot of money off of this.
That's why I think we were there.
Yeah,
but,
exactly. And I hate to sound jaded about it, but I can tell you, for example, that some of the soldiers that I've spoken to over there, people that I know personally, said that they saw these huge semi-dump trucks driving back and forth between Iraq and Kuwait with the big bucket on the back of these dump trucks filled with sand, you know, moving piles of sand around the clock for 24 hours a day, for weeks on end, you know, costing, and this was done by a company called Kellogg Brown and Root, or KBR for short, and they were doing this for weeks, you know, charging the taxpayers millions of dollars to do so. I mean, can you name another place besides Iraq that actually needs more sand than they already have? I mean,
yeah.
I can't.
Well, look at Halliburton. They finally got charged with overcharging, what, $1 billion for services like food and different things to the troops?
That's right.
And
yeah.
They were supposed to have paid it back. I don't know whether they ever did or not. And
well,
yet,
you know, it's, yeah.
Yet they were allowed to continue with the contract.
I know. You know, it's the kind of thing where it seems pretty obvious to me that, you know, when you start a war, that there's a lot of machinery that's going to be brought into place to support and supply and maintain those kinds of operations, and, you know, somebody's obviously going to be making a lot of money.
Well, it's a little strange to me when the company that made the most money over there was a company where the vice president used to be chairman of the board. You know?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
How do you get around something like that?
I don't think that you really can. I think that, you know, it just shows that... And I think this is why, you know, some people, if they really dig deeply and they look into these stories, they begin to realize that so much of what happens around the world is driven by corporate interests and not by a real desire to bring freedom and democracy to some group of people. It's more for the reason of exploiting the resources in the areas where those wars are being prosecuted. And in fact, you know, a lot of people say, well, what the heck are we doing in Afghanistan? I mean, if we're not there to fight terrorism, why are we there? Well, why were the Russians there? Why would they bother? Was it because they wanted to sort of work their way down in the Middle East and, you know, tap into some of the oil? Or was it because of some, you know, oil pipeline that was going to pass through Pakistan and Afghanistan and these other places to bring it down into an area where it could be accessible to the tankers that were supplying the rest of the world? Well, there are a lot of answers, but one of the things that we know now about Afghanistan is that it's a country that's very rich in a lot of rare earth minerals.
That's
things
right.
That are very difficult to get of. And we know this because the Russians were there surveying all this stuff. They, you know, they discovered these different veins of these different kind of ores and minerals and things. And this is one of the main reasons they wanted to be there. And, you know, you have to imagine that if, you know, if these are things that obviously these little tribal groups would never be able to exploit, but they could certainly be employed as miners and, you know, truck drivers and this kind of thing to handle and process and transport the ore or dig it out of the ground. You know, so it would have been a boom for the economy if it had been allowed to happen. But I think that, you know, the U.S. government was probably very concerned about, you know, what the problem would be becoming even more dependent on, say, the Russians for obtaining these rare earth minerals that are used in a lot of our weapon systems. You know, these detection devices, electro-optical devices that use a lot of these different kinds of minerals. I think most of the titanium in the world is mined and processed in Russia. So even there, you know, we have a bit of a strategic vulnerability because we're depending on someone that was a big enemy of ours for many years for a material that has a lot of, you know, real strategic uses.
You know, during the attacks of 9/11, some facts came out I thought were very interesting. One of the facts was that under one of the buildings, under one of the World Trade buildings, was a vault. And in that vault was evidence that the FBI was keeping for investigations, and that all disappeared. Have you heard that one?
Well, the story that I heard was that, as you probably know, the mayor of New York had a $20 million bomb-proof facility, an emergency facility that had been designed and built into World Trade Center 7. And it was that same facility that never got used and was never even occupied after the two World Trade Center towers were impacted by the aircraft. But that was a building where all the records for the prosecution and the ongoing cases on the part of the Security and Exchange Commission were going on against Enron and some of these other big corporations that the Bush administration had direct ties to from their prior employment and from relationships they had in the business world. But the story that I'd heard regarding these big vaults below the Trade Center was that there was $23 billion in gold bullion.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask you that next, because concerning that gold bullion, when they found, when they went through the wreckage and they found the gold bullion was gone, it had to have been taken out of there before the towers collapsed, because it needed trucks to be moved.
That's right. In fact, there were people who, in fact, that was the same area where a lot of the subway systems came into the building complex. And there were witnesses who described seeing large groups of heavily armed men, all in black, who were transporting these carts that were covered with what appeared to be bricks of some kind, you know, under the coverings that they'd placed over these carts, and they're being put into armored vehicles and hauled out of there in a very hurried way. So, you know, at the very least, this shows you that someone knew something was about to happen. And whatever happened to that, gold bullion, I don't think anybody knows. I've never heard anyone follow up on that story. And then, of course, there's all the stock market put offers that were made against American Airlines and United Airlines from a source somewhere in Langley, Virginia, about a week before the strikes on the World Trade Center. So we know that the stocks for American Airlines and United Airlines and many of the other airlines fell precipitously after the 9/11 attacks because nobody wanted to fly. They were terrified. You know,
that's
really the purpose of terrorism, is to terrify and scare people, you know, make them afraid to do things.
But don't you think if this was a true terrorist attack, that these buildings would not have come straight down?
No, I don't think they would have. In fact, the second building that was impacted, if you look at some of the footage of its collapse, you'll notice that the initial impact of the airliner that went in the building, it didn't go in wings level, it went in on a diagonal. And that when the building actually began to collapse, the upper section of the building sheared off on a diagonal, and actually portions of the building did break away and did collapse onto some of the surrounding structures. So it wasn't a clean, building demolition the way the first building that was hit. In fact, it was the first building to be hit that collapsed in the second position, that is to say. It collapsed after the second building.
Well, I remember one of the buildings keeled over and was leaning against another building. I can't remember which one it was.
Yeah, it was the second building to be hit, and I was not, and I am not familiar enough with the numeration on the towers to know which, you know, was building one, which was building two, but I do remember what I saw in terms of the way that it collapsed, and it did seem as though the first of the two buildings to collapse did begin to fall into its footprint, but there was a part of it that sheared off on a diagonal, starting with the stress riser that was created by that aircraft flying in and hitting the building on a diagonal.
Well, an interesting part of that building was that its outside frame was used also to structurally improve the integrity of the building. It wasn't just the core that was holding that building up.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is something that you can duplicate on a small scale. One of the things that you see very often, not only in advanced composite structures in the military, but you also see it in something simple like a surfboard, is that you can take what is a relatively buoyant and soft foam core center surfboard, and you wrap a synthetic material like fiberglass or Kevlar, and you impregnate it with the resin that binds it all together, and the rigidity that results having this amounts to a hard plastic shell on the outside of a soft high flotation core amounts to the creation of a very strong composite structure, and that's kind of the same idea that went into the design of the World Trade Center. You had a central core where all of the elevators were going to the various floors that had these, you know, very large, very, very strong, very thick steel girders that went up in a pattern. I think there were 48 columns that went up through the center of the building. And then there were these large girders that were around the outside of the building that act as very much like the shell that you would find on the outside of a surfboard. And then strung in between and stabilizing the two structures were the various floors that tied everything together. And so that's, you know, that's that has the making of a very powerful structure. And so one of the ways that you would want to be able to bring that structure down is to either collapse the core, which is supporting the lion's share of the weight, or to destabilize the outside so that it would in some way create what was called or what is called a stress riser, where the stress can't be transferred through the materials because of a break that's been created by the impact of the airliner. And so the stresses have to be transferred to other parts of the building to maintain and support the weight of all that, you know, the millions of tons of concrete and steel that are above that. And, you know, if that stress cannot be, you know, transferred through other members of the supporting structure, eventually it'll begin to collapse or bend or a fracture. And that's ultimately what happened with what I believe was the augmentation of explosives inside the building itself.
Well, I think an interesting event, I shouldn't put it that way maybe, but an interesting event was the first bombing of the World Trade Center where they exploded a whole truck full of ammonium nitrate, I believe it was. And they couldn't take that building down. And that the force of that explosion was probably just as strong as the force of the plane hitting the side of the building.
Well, I would dispute that only because I think that you know, the impact of an aircraft is a much more focused event. It all travels along the line of the trajectory of the aircraft, and so the aircraft and its wings and all the structures of the aircraft coming in at just under 600 miles an hour, from what I recall, will have a tremendous point of contact.
Well, it has a lot of kinetic energy. That's what you're talking about,
exactly.
Right?
Okay, that's exactly right. But when you have an explosion using a truck full of ammonium nitrate, the explosion goes out in all directions, and the further you get away from the actual event, the amount of force that it imparts drops off, you know, something like as...
Well, the reason I said that was because the truck had been placed near the central core of the building.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It was in the parking structure.
It was near the central core, so it was pretty much placed where it might do the most damage, you know.
Well, I think the intent, if I remember correctly, the blind sheikh that they interviewed and interrogated after those events had said that the intent was that they wanted to cause one of the buildings to collapse, fall over, and hit the other building,
right,
and cause
right.
it to fall also like a huge dynamo. And then that, of course, you know, the idea was that it would probably collapse and fall into, you know, the financial core of Wall Street in that area, because of its height. But you know, picturing those buildings as dominoes, I don't think was probably a very effective approach to take. But I saw the photographs. I was doing some work for Popular Mechanics magazine that did an extensive write-up about that explosion. I talked to the science director and the art director over there, who had a chance to go in and see some of these things and had a lot of photographs to look at. And it was obvious that, ammonium nitrate is the same kind of explosive that were used in the Murrah office building in Oklahoma City.
That's correct, yeah.
About the same time, too, I think, wasn't it?
I think it was a little before, but I'm not sure.
I guess Waco, Texas was 1993, and then the Murrah office building was 1 or 2 years after that.
Yeah, I believe so, and then the World Trade Center, yeah.
But that's the same kind of explosives that were being used, and they're nowhere near as powerful or as damaging as thermite or thermate explosive, because those kinds of explosive materials produce a tremendous amount of heat, which can not only damage steel structures, but can actually melt the steel structures if they're properly placed because of the extreme energy achieved during the process. So.
Do you think that, say there was an investigation, a really thorough investigation into 9/11, would you be shocked to find out that evidence was found that might implicate people that were high up in the government?
No, I wouldn't be surprised by that at all. I don't think that the federal government would ever permit such an in-depth investigation. I mean, we know that one of the people at the top of the security firm that was responsible for overseeing the security of the World Trade Center was Marvin Bush, the younger brother
right.
of the president.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in fact, in the week and a half, 2 weeks prior to 9/11, that the security systems for those buildings were supposedly undergoing a refurbishment, and there were dozens and dozens of men carrying huge duffel bags with equipment that they would never show to the on-duty security people who were in the building, supposedly protecting the building.
Mm-hmm.
All of the bomb-sniffing dogs that they had as part of the security perimeter for the World Trade Center were removed from the site, not allowed to be brought into the site. And to me, these are real big flags that suggest that someone not only knew that there were explosive materials being brought into the building, but that the supposed rewiring of the entire closed-circuit camera system seems like a wonderful cover for placing all of the electrical wiring through the core of the building that would be responsible to set off controlled demolition charges throughout the building. And I personally believe that that's what happened. So, I would not be surprised if there were some links found to people high in the government. I wouldn't be surprised at all.
A website called FBIWhistlestop.com states that a justice found that Rumsfeld and a senior FBI officer took souvenirs from 9/11 sites, and that FBI agents had taken pieces of the debris to give to dignitaries as souvenirs. What do you think of this?
Well, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, the nature of people is such that, especially when there's a significant event or some part of history, there's always going to be someone who's going to want to have a piece of that building. I mean, I imagine that there are probably people who had family members who died in those buildings that may have a piece of those buildings on the mantle today. As a kind of remembrance of their loved ones and the terrible event that occurred. The same thing happened during the Vietnam War and the Second World War, even the First World War. People would come home with, maybe an old German helmet with a bullet hole in it or something. And I think that's one of the ways that the people, feel that they've participated in and been a part of history. So it's not surprising to me. I think that if they had taken a piece of human bone or something from the World Trade Center and given it away as a memento, a souvenir, that would be a travesty. But it doesn't surprise me that people took pieces of the building and gave them to other people as sort of a piece of history.
Do you think that the debris from the buildings that was moved away so fast was moved that way because it was a cover-up?
Well, I heard someone say, and I think it was a line from one of the documentaries, Loose Change or In Plain Sight, some of the documentaries that were so skillfully put together in the wake of that whole event. I think that the statement that the federal government was in the process of rapidly removing the evidence of a major crime, and that it was a crime scene. And I really believe that the idea that they were going to dig down through this rubble and find people that needed to be saved or rescued, I think there were only maybe five or six people total that somehow survived the collapse of this building. I think there were firemen down in the basement, if I recall correctly. There was a movie made about it. But I just cringe at the thought that, that any government, let alone our government, had a hand in that, and that, removing that material in the name of trying to save anyone trapped in the debris was really just a cover for hiding up whatever evidence there may have been, some of which I think Stephen Jones from BYU really did find when he did these spectroscopy readings off of the residue from the buildings.
Well, when we look at the Pentagon attack now, that's even more incredible to me. Nobody saw a plane hit the building, and pilots have stated that even though they might have been flying for 20 or 30 years, there's no way that they could have flown 50 feet above the ground or lower and crashed into the side of the Pentagon, and hit it. What do you think of that?
Well, there are a lot of things that suggest that it may have been something that would have been, size-wise, would have been closer to the size of a Learjet loaded with explosives. The explosion that came from that impact had a lot of red, fiery smoke and black smoke that came from it, which really shows the combustion of things like fuel rather than explosives. When you have a high explosive being used, you see a lot of brilliant flashes. You see a lot of things being projected out of or ejected out of the point of impact. And so it's hard to say. I know that I did see a photograph of a section of a landing gear that was brought out of the building.
I saw that too.
Were, mm-hmm. And it was something that looked a lot more like what you would expect to find on a Learjet than what you would see.
Absolutely. It didn't have the right amount of lug nuts on it, for one thing.
Well, not only that, yeah. I mean, a large plane has large landing gear, and the landing gear that you'll find on a 767 is so big and so heavy, even if it's made out of a magnesium alloy, that five or six people probably wouldn't be able to lift it. It easily probably weighs 600 or 700 pounds. And so the idea that you've got, a couple of guys with a piece of plywood hauling landing gear from a 767 out of the building with a tire and a wheel on it that's, 16, 17 inches in diameter, the wheel part of it anyway, it just isn't consistent with the size of the aircraft that they say was supposed to fly in the building. And then on top of that, if you look at an aerial view immediately after the impact, you find that for the building to have hit, for the Pentagon to have been hit in the ground floors by the main fuselage section of the aircraft, the two large engines that were slung under the wings of that kind of an aircraft would have, created two big ruts that would
Absolutely.
Have crossed several hundred yards worth of the Pentagon's lawn before the actual impact occurred. And then probably one of the more disturbing aspects of that whole thing was the different layers as you go into the building, and you can see less and less degree of destruction in the structural parts of the building. And there was even on one of the inner rings, there was what looked like a small hole where some part of the aircraft, the fuselage, had presumably penetrated that far into the building. And what was really odd was that there was a spray paint circle around it that said, cut here.
Yeah, well,
with the word
"
cut here next to it.
That hole, they think that hole was created by the rescue team.
Well, maybe it was, except that it was burned. It was burned all around that area. So I don't know whether that was something that was done by the rescue people or by the impact itself, but it just didn't seem to me like whatever it was that hit the Pentagon had enough kinetic energy to carry very far into the building.
Well, not only that, but when you look at the impact area, you can see that whatever hit the side of the Pentagon certainly didn't have large wings with two big engines sticking down, because there's no, the hole is far too small, and there's no marks where the engine would have hit the wall. where the engines,
right,
rather, would have hit the wall. And nobody's
right.
really been able to explain that, and they just don't talk about it.
I know. I know. I mean, they did have one guy who came forward and made a statement on camera. Oh, yeah, I saw a 767, and it came in over the freeway. But, you know, if you really look at the guy, you look at his body language, you know, the way his eyes are darting around as he's recounting what he supposedly saw, everything about the way he's acting, manifests the earmarks of someone who's telling a lie.
Yeah,
one of the reasons they use the phrase downright liar is because it comes from the discovery on the part of psychologists that when people lie, when they knowingly tell a falsehood, that there's something going on in the brain that actually makes your eyes dart down and to the right, downright liar. And in fact, when you see politicians making statements about what they're going to do when they become president, watch their eyes. And if you see them, especially, this is especially true of Al Gore when he was running for president, when you see people making promises and saying, you know, they're going to do X, Y, Z when they become president, if you see their eyes darting around and they dart down and to the right, you can almost be sure that they're just making stuff up as they go. And this is the kind of body language being exhibited by the airline at the side of the Pentagon.
Well, it's interesting to note that several poles were knocked down, but they weren't. The poles, after they were examined, investigators came to the conclusion that they were never hit by a plane. What happened was they were knocked down with explosives.
Really?
That's right.
You know, I had never heard that. You're talking about the streetlight poles.
That's correct.
That were along the sides of the freeway that ran parallel to the Pentagon.
That's correct.
One of the other things that I found kind of disturbing was that individuals claiming to be FBI agents seemed to know where all of the local closed-circuit camera systems were at gas mm-hmm. stations and restaurants and grocery stores, all along the flight path that this airliner supposedly took. They came in, they confiscated all of those videotapes that would have shown or given any indication of what the aircraft type was, and those films have never been shown. They've never been released. There have been multiple Freedom of Information Acts and requests made to obtain those films, and the FBI or whoever it was that had, you know, secured these recordings have never released them.
Well, did you know that investigators have created reenactments of the flight path of the plane from witnesses' testimony, and they found that it would have been impossible for a plane that would be on that flight path to have hit the Pentagon?
You know, I've heard that. I haven't actually seen the study. I did see a video graphic simulation of how the plane actually flew, and it appeared as though the plane actually flew a spiral pattern around the plane, as though the individual who was flying it was trying to decide which side of the building to hit, eventually coming in and impacting the southwest corner, which, as it happens, was the area of the Pentagon that had just undergone a complete refurbishment and updating of a lot of the features to make areas of the building bomb-proof. So it was the one side of the building where you might have expected that there would be the least amount of damage from such an impact, and that you would have a higher survivability factor for anyone in the building if there was a plane flying in on that side, because it had undergone this extensive refurbishment along that side of the Pentagon.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Did you know that there was a group of investigators from California that conducted a 3-year investigation into the attack, and they came up with a finding that it was a planned military operation? What do you think of that?
I'm not surprised by that. And that would probably be true whether it was conducted by Muslim extremists or some branch of the military or even the intelligence community, because, you know, it was expertly timed. You know, you have, according to the historical accounts, you have, four groups of terrorists that are supposedly hijacking planes that are all going to be redirected towards Washington and New York City. And the timing for each of these events happens to fall at almost the exact same moment that there is a very, very large military training exercise that's occurring all over the northeastern part of the United States. And so anyone who is participating in that particular training exercise is immediately going to question whether or not the real live impact of the World Trade Center by an airliner is a simulation and part of the exercise to gauge their reaction and their ability to cope under the stress of such a situation, or is this the real thing? And it took them probably a good half hour, 45 minutes to realize that this is something that had actually happened, that they weren't being shown, you know, doctored films to, you know, see what their reactions were as part of a training exercise, but it was a real live attack that was timed exactly when this training exercise was ongoing. So, you know, that kind of inside knowledge seems to be, I really believe that that's kind of beyond the capability and the scope of Muslim terrorists. I think that there had to be someone else involved, someone that had intimate knowledge of what was going to be going on with the U.S. and the Canadian military at the time.
Are you familiar with the photo of the apartment building in Amsterdam that was hit by a 747?
No, I've never seen that.
Well, there's a building in Amsterdam. A 747 flew into the side of it. And the interesting part is that the hole is way wider than the same hole in the Pentagon. That's the only reason I bring this up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, it has, I don't know, I think it's about 185 or 250-foot wingspan. I mean, it's a very, very large plane. Of course, you know, in order for an aircraft that size to get airborne, it has to be made of, you know, the lightest materials you can think of that have the highest amount of strength. And you're talking about things like aluminum, magnesium, and titanium alloys, and a lot of plastic and composite materials on the inside of the aircraft, you know, where the seats and the, you know, the luggage racks and so forth are located. And, you know, you fill something like that up with a lot of fuel, and, you know, you can expect that it'll have a certain amount of inertia when it flies into the side of the building, even though, you know, the wing structure of the aircraft is designed to take a certain kind of dynamic loading, you know, in the lifting of the aircraft itself as the air passes over the wings. These structures are not really designed to handle the impact of, you know, being flown into a building, and so one would expect that the wings would shear off within the first few feet of penetration into the building, and that the lion's share of what would damage the inside of the building would be, you know, the length of the fuselage, you know, basically compacting like a giant accordion as it went into the building, you know, with the first part of it crumbling inward and the tail section basically being a pile driver that pushes the rest of the material.
Well, you still have a lot of weight there, though. I think an empty plane
absolutely.
That size is like 265,000 pounds, but
that's
without fuel and without passengers and everything.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But I see your point, the wings shear off, but at the initial contact point, the shearing effect is just starting, so you still have that wide hole, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have that at all in the side of the Pentagon. There's not even a mark after the hole on either side on the wall.
That's right. At least until the fires that came afterward caused the building, the walls of the outer walls of the building to collapse.
Yes.
But in the initial stages, when the smoke began to clear and the firefighters were in there putting out the fires and so forth, it seemed pretty obvious to me that it wasn't an aircraft of the scale that they alleged had actually been flown in there. And in fact, I had seen a report, and it escapes me at the moment who put this report together, but they were tracking the flight path of that particular aircraft, that particular airliner, and someone alleged that that aircraft actually wound up landing at some place.
Yes, I heard that.
For about a half an hour, and that everyone deplaned, and that the aircraft then departed again later. I mean, and this is the thing about the Pentagon. I mean, you can understand you know, the scarcity of human remains and the collapse of, you know, a World Trade Center building, you know, over 1,000 feet high or something, you know, basically obliterating any kind of evidence of soft tissues and that kind of thing. But in the case of the Pentagon, where you have a relatively small area of damage and a limited amount of, collateral damage caused in the fires and the collapse of the building, you would expect to find a plane load of bodies in there. And
absolutely,
there were nothing. There was
absolutely
nothing. And in fact, you know, they there were a number of body bags that were seen being taken out of the Pentagon. But the press was never given access to the morgue where these remains were taken. And in fact, within 4 or 5 days after that event occurred, those remains were supposedly moved to yet another morgue where suddenly there were a lot more body parts that didn't seem to be evident in the beginning.
Right.
So it's a very peculiar situation. I don't remember hearing anything about DNA testing being done on any of those remains before they were, buried or cremated. And, I've always wondered, after looking at all of the evidence in the Pentagon case, whether there isn't a plane load of people, maybe former government employees, who are, secretly living on a Pacific island somewhere, knowing that they helped play a vital role in, sort of bringing off this terrible scenario.
Or they were all murdered.
Well, that's a possibility. That's a possibility too. But you know, I mean, that's, to me, the idea that a plane load of people would be killed to, you know, give some validity to a story, it doesn't make sense. Especially when they weren't even willing to expend a full size airliner to bring off the appearance of an attack on the Pentagon. That just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, the reason I say that is I can't help but feel that anybody that would kill 3,000 people in the World Trade Center would have no problem at all killing an airliner full of people.
Yeah, I suppose that's a good point. It just sounds like pure evil to me.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, the public never saw any debris, really, from this Pentagon crash, yet it was reported that two black boxes were recovered, and then we heard no more about it. Now, doesn't it sound very suspicious that two black boxes would survive a supposed crash that disintegrated a plane? I mean, it's not like it crashed in the ocean or anything, you know?
Well, I know that the black boxes, as they're called, that record all of the communications and telemetry and flight input signals from the aircraft are usually in the tail section of the aircraft, and in an impact like this, flying into a mountainside or a building or what have you, that they're positioned in the aircraft fuselage in such a way that they have the highest potential for surviving, you know, such an impact. And they're also engineered out of extremely strong, very thick steel components to ensure not only the survival but even the survival of the recordings if there's a fire as a consequence of the crash. So getting black boxes is one thing, but you know, whether or not they were the actual black boxes from a particular aircraft type is another question entirely. The fact that no one's ever been able to see any of the telemetry is part of an investigation to show that, you know, these are the real live flight control inputs that would have brought an aircraft into this position at this time and space. You know, the fact that no one's ever been able to see that strongly suggests to me that there's some falsification going on in the evidence there. Because like you were saying before, there are a lot of experienced pilots who say, you know, with, you know, 20, 30 years of piloting experience, they could never have achieved what this pilot did in terms of bringing the plane down where and when he did in such a way that he did, especially in an airliner. So the idea that some guy with, 6 months of training at a pilot school in Florida or Arizona could do this kind of a thing it just doesn't seem credible.
And he was training on a Cessna.
Yeah. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, you know, I've taken five different media orientation rides in, some of the U.S. military's top fighter planes over the years, the A-7, the F-15, the F-16, the F-4 Phantom, and I've had a chance to fly the planes, and I don't even have a pilot's license, but as a conceptual artist, as someone who's spent a lot of time designing things and working around aircraft but never flying them, you know, it was a really educational experience to see what these pilots have to go through to be able to not only figure out what's happening with this, you know, really complicated piece of machinery, but to also be able to sense the dynamics and the loading of the wings and things as you manipulate the plane. You know, the control system in the F-16 is entirely different than any of the other aircraft types that I flew in. It's a joystick that sits on the right console of the cockpit, and all of the input into that joystick, if you want to call it that, is based on the amount of pressure and not so much the amount of deflection that occurs in the joystick. If you're in an F-4 Phantom or an F-15, you move the stick around, and it's the degree of movement that controls how fast and how quickly the plane will turn and accelerate into a turn.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't that because all of the other planes are they're not fly-by-wire, but the plane, the F-16, wasn't that just about completely computer-controlled?
That's right. That's why it was nicknamed the electric jet, because all of the inputs in the control system that controlled the hydraulics for the flight control surfaces was all controlled electronically from the cockpit. In the other instances, many of the control inputs were all direct control inputs into a hydraulic system that would then, you know, convey those messages through pressure, through tubing that would go to the actuators and the different parts of the flight control systems, you know, the flaps and the wings and this kind of thing. So you're absolutely right, Ken. And but, you know, trying to get used to something like that, even with the experiences that I had in less complicated aircraft, it's something that takes a lot of training, a lot more training than I would imagine that these so-called terrorists that hijacked the plane could have had in the short amount of time that they had available to them to do this training. You know, working on simulators and things like that, there is just no way that you have any sense of what the plane's going to do, how it's going to respond when you create a certain amount of input into the controls. It's just not the same as actually being out there and having the real-life experience of flying the airplane. And so I come down on the side of the pilots who said that they really think that there's something else going on here, because to have achieved those kinds of piloting skills on such limited training just doesn't seem credible to me.
Well, what was your feeling, if you remember, and if you saw this, when Rumsfeld came running out of the Pentagon with his sleeves rolled up, running towards injured people and just trying to, help them and et cetera. I mean, now that you look back on it from your point of view today, what would you think of that?
Well, first impression is one of, you know, here's a hero. Here's an American who's, you know, ready to get down and dirty with the people and save lives. But, you know, if you step back a few feet and you look at it in its overall perspective, two words come to my mind, and that is photo op.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too.
Yeah. And, you know, and I know I sound a little jaded because, you know, I have a lot of respect for the people who run this country, and you know, I like to think that, you know, such a thing could never have been something that was planned at the highest levels of this government. But there's just too many strange things about, you know, what happened on that day to not at least ask the question, you know, what was really happening here? I mean, because everything indicates those buildings had help being brought down, particularly Building 7. I mean, that's the one chink in the armor of this entire story, is how the heck could a building that wasn't impacted by anything, wasn't hit by any debris from the planes colliding with the World Trade Center, how could that building that held such really, truly important documents to an ongoing prosecution of some major corporations in this country, how could that building be brought down in such a perfect way? And you have to understand, Ken, that if you're going to use controlled demolition to bring down a building, any building, you're talking about weeks of planning and preparation. It's not something you do in two or three hours on an afternoon in September. It's something that takes a tremendous amount of logistical support. People have to be brought in. Supplies have to be brought in. Wiring has to be routed through the entire building. There has to be, you know, dozens and dozens of people who are familiar with engineering this kind of an event that have to be brought in, consulted. The blueprints of the entire building have to be brought to bear. This is not something that you do in an afternoon when the building is empty in just a few hours. It's something that takes weeks and weeks, if not months.
Well, not only that, if I remember correctly, when we dropped a nuclear weapon on Hiroshima, the only thing that survived at Ground Zero was a bank vault.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the bank vault inside of that building should have been able to survive, and I think it did, but I think all the evidence was missing out of it.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So yeah. How does one explain that, you know?
Somebody knew it was coming.
Yeah, they took the evidence out before the attack.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah.
My point. And the last question I want to ask you is, do you think, well, let me make this two questions. What did you think about President Bush when he was talking to the children in the class and he was told about the attack and continued on with what he was doing? How did you feel about that?
Well, that was another strange segment from that particular day that didn't have the ring of truth to me. And that's because if you've ever watched the Secret Service on duty around the president, when anything that is perceived to be a threat to the president of the United States happens, I mean, a bank robbery three blocks down the street.
He's whisked away.
Those guys
are
all over the president. They hustle him into a limousine. He's surrounded front and aft by these big SUVs that have the Gatling guns that pop out of the ceilings that can put out 4,000 rounds at anything that comes near the president. And yet they didn't do that in this particular instance. And you have to ask yourself, was this because they didn't want to frighten the children? That, you know, the president felt that it was more important to the situation and to the historical record to sit there and continue to talk nicely to these little kids because of the impression they would create later? Or did he really know that truly he was not the focus of the intent of these attacks, that it was really a staged event, the complexity of which and the extent of which was known in advance, and so there was an understanding that he as a president was not under any direct threat at that particular moment in place and time. Just something didn't ring true to me about that whole thing, because, you know, ordinarily I would have expected a lot more than one of his PR people to come up and whisper something in his ear like, you know, there's just been an airplane flown into the World Trade Center, we need to get you out of here as soon as possible. I would have thought that under those circumstances that he would have stood up immediately and told the children that there's an emergency and I have to leave, and please remember how important it is to study and learn in school, and then boom, he'd be gone.
Yeah, I felt that he would have been whisked away. He wouldn't even have a chance to do that. Yeah, but I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with you.
The last thing I want to ask you is: do you think that someone would go that far to be reelected?
Well, you know, I honestly don't think that it had anything to do with reelection. I really don't. I think that this entire scenario or plan, if you can call it that, was really about polarizing the United States into a mindset where people would accept that we had to go into the Middle East and we had to get some payback. And if we got our hands on a lot of petroleum deposits in the process, well, so much the better. And that I think was the cold, hard perspective that was the basis for the entire operation, that it was about, using the cover of warfare and defending our freedom, so supposedly, against terrorism, and use that as a cover for securing resources that were vital to, you know, the American economy.
And also for passing bills that took away some of the rights of the citizens, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was very disappointed that the Congress voted the way that they did recently in restoring the Patriot Act. I really felt that. I mean, and, you know, the idea that you have these characters from the Transportation Security Agency down at the airport groping little girls, you know, and screaming and crying and don't touch me, don't touch me. You know, to me, this just, it sounds like the beginnings of the Nazis taking over Germany.
Absolutely, absolutely. Plus the fact that every phone call made in the whole world now is monitored.
Well, that's been true for a long time. I knew that that was true as far back as the early to mid 1980s. I had a friend, my best friend, was going through the ITT Technical Institute in Los Angeles, studying to become an IT professional, and there was a kid in one of his classes who worked at Peterson Air Force Base near Colorado Springs, Colorado, and he said that they have a huge building on the base, multiple floors, every floor filled with Cray supercomputers, these big parallel processing computer systems. And he said that every single phone call in the world is recorded and digitally stored somewhere in files that that go back years and years. And so they have all of the things that I think it was the film with Harrison Ford called The Clear and Present Danger, where they talk about using a system like Echelon to be able to use voice recognition to track terrorists and criminals. Just when they talk over the phone, whether no matter where the phone call is, no matter what kind of format, whether it's satellite-based or cell phone-based or ground line, that every phone call everywhere in the world is being recorded all the time. So that's been true for a long time. And, you know, you can understand how that would be a tremendous resource for not only law enforcement, Interpol, and, you know, the secret services of many different nations, but you know, it really kind of shows you that the so-called Privacy Act under Title V of the United States Code is really just kind of window dressing.
Yeah.
That's really all it is.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you.